Talkback with Gary Null, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot to share, the latest on health and healing. Then, from our What's New in Medicine, we're going to talk about the 15 dirty big pharmaceutical tricks that rip you off and risk your health for profit by Martha Rosenberg of Alternet. From our special issue section, and I'm going to invite you after I talk about our issue section to call in and share your point of view. I appreciate the type of responses this audience offers to our issues. The issue today, the social network. It really nails Harvard and America. Disease obsessed with elitism. Sarah Seltzer from Alternet. Nutrient of the day, blueberries, and how they can help halt metabolic syndrome. And that means it can help prevent heart disease and diabetes. Have a lot to share. No guest. Let's get started. I found this interesting. This was from the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. As reported in Science Daily, it says the more secure you feel, the less you value your stuff. People who feel more secure in receiving love and acceptance from others place less monetary value on their possessions. This is from the University of New Hampshire. The research was conducted by a professor of psychology, and in their experiments, researchers measure how much people valued specific items. And they found that, quote, people value possessions in part because they afford a sense of protection, insurance, and comfort. But what we found was that if people already have a feeling of being loved and accepted by others, which can provide a sense of protection, insurance, and comfort, those possessions decrease in value. It was interesting because one of the things I do each day is if I ride a cab, I try to get to know something about the cab driver. I get an intuitive feeling. Today it was a Sikh, a member of a specific religious order, and one of the major tenets of that religious order is service to others in need. So I asked a question. I said, what happens when a blind person gets in your cab? And he said, I never charge them. And I said, what about someone who has a physical handicap? He said, I don't charge them either. Okay, I felt confident then that he could pass on the energy. So when I got to my office, I paid, and then I gave him $10. I said, for the next person that gets in the cab, just tell him another New Yorker who cares about people and wanted them to have a gift today. And he smiled. He said, that's okay. He said, you don't have to do that. I said, it's not about, I don't have to do it. I want to do it. I believe each day that we should share something from our spiritual nature to a stranger, someone we'll never meet. Much like Krishnamurti once said to me, he said, I will always pick up the stone, even though I will never see the person that will not step on it. And when he told me that, I thought, wow. So then every time running around Center Park, if I saw a branch or a rock, I would stop and put it out of the way for the biker, runner, walker that wouldn't have to step on it. Now, what if all the people in this country, every day, with no exception, did something on a spiritual level? How much better are you going to feel about yourself just for honoring your spiritual value? And then if you're honoring your spiritual value, how much less energy are you going to be trying to absorb out of someone else to gain some sense of value? How much attention and time are you putting into material possessions or the need for them? And hence working very late at night, as people on Wall Street do. I live on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. In the building I live, a lot of people work in the financial community. When I come back from doing my run in the morning, they're going to work. When I come back at night from my office, they're coming home. The difference is I'll break my day up. I'll have dinner, a movie with friends. I'll do something that's important to me. Maybe I'll go for a walk in the park or go to a museum, which I never tire of. They don't. They work all day long. They drink a lot of coffee or they take cocaine, but they're buzzed. Why? They run their dog out to the curb when they get back. I watch it. Because they're insecure. Now, they can be very wealthy, come from elite institutions, and be considered top of their class. But then they realize when they get out into the real world that there are a lot of top of class people. There are a lot of elite people, not tens, not thousands, not tens, thousands, or 100,000, millions. There was a time when being a millionaire was a big deal. Well, today there's 7 million millionaires, down from 10 million millionaires, so for a lot of people it's not a big deal. Then how comfortable are you with having your millions when you know someone else has more, or they have something different? And suddenly your whole attention is, I will feel a lot better about myself if I have what they have. Hence this need to congregate in certain enclaves, whether it's socializing. For example, there's an island in the right off South America. I've been there. I just find it a very barren place. I don't find anything interesting about it. But someone made it famous by hanging out there, and a yacht group hung out there, and suddenly everybody wants to hang there. It's like Chelsea. I find it a drab little place. But if enough people hang out there who are famous, suddenly it becomes famous for no other reason than the people who hang there. It's like going to the meat market down on 14th Street, and people are there over by the where the old meat, and still some of the meat comes in the city, and it's really dank. There's no joy in it. But a lot of very trendy places open up, and a lot of clubs and restaurants open up, so everybody says, this is the hot place to be. It's like, I remember on West Side Highway driving up one day, and I watched this building going up, and it was all glass, and I thought, that's interesting. Does anyone realize that when you're in an all-glass building and you get that afternoon sun on coming down the west side, they're going to be boiling? Well, sure enough, no one thought about that because these are just a bunch of rich idiots, and because they don't think for themselves. You know, they have their people. Ooh, who are their people? Well, they're smart little parasites who figure out that most rich people are very insecure and rather stupid. Having been to a lot of parties with a lot of rich people, my God, their collective IQ could, well, it's not above 60 in most cases. But you'd never know that because they're never going to talk about anything except what they know. And they surround themselves with people who sit there with big, doughy, starry eyes, just saying yes. But between now and then, a lot of people will make money in their career off of them. It's just amazing how everything is an illusion in our society. I mean, everything. Everything is an illusion. And everybody lies, and everybody's got their myth of a story. And rarely do you ever get to know the truth behind something. Well, anyhow, here's this building, and it goes up, and guess what? Everybody could see in. Now, here are these very private people who are allowing the whole world, as they drive up or down West Side Highway, to look in on them. Plus, they're getting boiling heat from the sun. So it was the hippest, hottest thing. Not only did they have one building, but immediately there were like five other buildings went up for $1, $2, and $3, and $6 million apartments. The trouble is, where do you hang the drapes when it's all glass? So now they had to go through enormous expense of re-engineering their apartments. And so they had some privacy. Well, if you're going to have privacy, then what is the purpose of glass? If your entire building is all glass, then why not just live in a normal building? Ah, well, that would make some sense, but not to these people, because they want to be seen. But no, hold on, they don't want to be seen. They only want to be seen when they want to be seen, when they're getting out of a car after their makeup and, you know, after someone stretched their cheeks and, you know, dyed their hair and taken the saliva out of their mouth and their nose and freshened up their breath. It smells like someone's bowels that have been in the sun for about a month dead. And finally, these people walk down a carpet as if, you know, gee whiz, look at me, aren't I just dandy? Well, I guess in this moment. Now, what about the rest of the time? And that's how we live our lives, by these obsessive needs for being someone we're not, acting out in stupid ways, having things we don't need, and sacrificing precious time in the process. Because sooner or later, every human being wakes up one morning and asks, "Dude, where's my life?" And someone's going to say, "How do I know where you've been for the last 5 years, 10 years, 3 years, 8 years? I don't know. I was just so..." And then the excuses come. Instead of just being able to say, "Hey, I'm going to wake up each day and I'm just going to put in my life what's important to me. What are the two things that life should be? Happiness and health. Everything else is of secondary importance." Because if you're happy, it doesn't matter who you're with or what you have. You're happy. And therefore, the people you're with are going to enjoy that. And if you're not happy, then more often than not, the people in your life are not going to be happy. And so a lot of unhappy people going through therapy, complaining all day, twittering about what's wrong. I mean, you're sitting there on a date and suddenly someone's twittering about, you know, what's wrong with the date. You know, the trouble is you're twittering the person that you're with. You can't even talk. "Hey, I'm not happy." Twitter, "I'm not either. You know, should we see each other again? I don't think so. I have to have my therapist first, my 17 girlfriends, who are also equally dysfunctional as myself." Jesus, man. What a mess. We're a nation of complete dysfunction. Now, as I distract myself, I'm going to deal with this in depth in a few moments in the social network. I'd love to debate any of the clowns from Harvard. I'd love to. Call in. Let's debate on anything. All right. I can't tell you the contempt I have for the image-conscious Ivy Leagues who produce the people who go out there and cause the damage to our world. In fact, I was watching 60 Minutes, and they actually did half of a good piece. They showed the impact of some children who are engaged in the world of poverty, who weren't before, and how they're struggling, living in motels, living in a van. Now, of course, we've been filming this for 3 years. It took 60 Minutes, I guess, and its producers, 3 years to figure out, gee whiz, maybe this is important. Well, okay. So they did it. And I thought what they did was good. And I commend them for at least showing the plight of these young children. What did they leave out of the story? One day, one single 24-hour period, are Afghan and Iraq wars cost as much as what it would take to feed all the homeless children for a month in the United States. And he asked in 60 Minutes, "How many of you in this classroom, how many of you have gone to bed hungry?" And all the hands went up. And then he explained, "What's it like?" Well, then I would have juxtapositioned that with Bill Gates and a man who wants eugenics, a man who believes that if you're poor and African, you don't have a right to be born. You know, contraceptive vaccines, that's the ticket. Or genetic engineering, his friends at Monsanto, real criminals at Monsanto. Look at the cases they've had to settle. I have them all. I'd love to see all the wealthy people, and when the last time they were ever hungry. I can tell you one thing. I don't believe any of the wealthy people in America are happy. I'm sure there are exceptions. I just haven't met them. Not by any standard of true happiness on a spiritual level. And that's why they just keep making more money and putting everyone else at risk. My God, don't we realize we would all be better off if the wealthy simply stopped, retired, go to West Palm Beach, all the other plastic people, or Palm Springs, look like a prune, or down in Naples. Why don't we just let all these people retire and then allow us to live our lives without them interjecting anything that they have to say or do, because all they do is hurt everyone else. Those are my own personal opinions. Now to some health nutrition information. Obesity may boost the odds of aggressive breast cancer in older women. This is the latest study on this, and from Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. It says, obesity is known to be both the risk of estrogen-fueled breast cancer in women past menopause. Now, new research suggests a link between postmenopause obesity and especially aggressive type breast cancer that doesn't depend upon estrogen to grow. So it means you don't have to have excess estrogen. If you're just fat, you're going to be more likely to develop cancer. And we've been saying a long time, many, many times, there is no such thing as being overweight and healthy. Happiness rewarded with longevity. Now, here's some good news. from Applied Psychology. The results of multiple studies called a meta-analysis reveal a significant association between happiness and longer life. University of Illinois Professor Emeritus showed that if you are happy, you're less stressed, and that in itself can allow you to live a longer life. Well, we know, because when you're stressed, you're more likely to overeat, eat bad foods, not exercise, or exercise too much, and take drugs or alcohol. New research links diabetes with higher death risk from some cancers. This is another study that's of importance at Cambridge University. It says a 50-year-old with diabetes dies 6 years sooner than someone without the disease, and not just from a heart attack or a stroke. The large international effort measures diabetes toll found the disease also raises the risk of dying prematurely from all other conditions. So if you got diabetes, you're just going to die quicker. And I don't think that's what you want, so pay attention to what you can do. And by the way, it doesn't hurt to watch the No More Diabetes film. That will certainly help you. And finally, apples' antioxidant content can boost lifespan. This is brand new information from the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. Quote, further evidence of the ability of apple antioxidants to boost the lifespan of test animals is supplied in the form of a new study. Lead researcher Dr. Chen and colleagues report that consuming antioxidants in apples extended the average lifespan in this scientific study by 10%. Well, we know, and this was done at Chinese University in Hong Kong, we know that antioxidants help you live longer. Why? Because the reason that we all get sick and die and have diseases and look older is because free radicals hit our cells and they injure the cell. Now, if they just killed the cell, that would actually be preferable. Because if you injure a cell and you don't have the nutrients in your body to repair the cell can be repaired into a dysfunctional cell that can end up going on to cause cancer and other conditions. And if you take your antioxidants, the antioxidants, including the high ORAC in fruits and vegetables, that traps the free radicals and that lengthens your lifespan. Then if you take a lot of the fruits and vegetables, either fresh, juiced, or powdered, then those go in and repair the damage to your DNA. So quite simply, by having lots of antioxidants, you're repairing the damage to your cell, you're preventing the cell from becoming cancerous, and you're extending your lifespan. I'm going to deal with this in greater depth on an upcoming program, but the latest research shows that, quote, dark times for the herbal medicine in Europe. And it says this, thousands of products from traditional medicine will become illegal throughout the European Union in just 3 weeks. And more European Union legislation influences U.S. domestic policy, especially where health-related laws are concerned. The European Union threat to herbal medicine is real. And what this means is that they passed a stunning 139,000 directives and regulations and decisions since 1980. And one of those was Codex Alimentarius. And so as of April 1st, you won't be able to buy the herbs you can right now in Europe. It'll be illegal, and that's unfortunate. We fought the fight to stop Codex Alimentarius. Let me give you a projection. I believe that they will apply Codex within the next 2 years in the United States. I believe that they'll start by showing that certain supplements are harmful, and to protect the public good, these should be harmonized at low doses. And since they control the media, they'll get their message out, both in the left and right media. Because the left media has been equally culpable of accepting anything the pharmaceutical industry says. And so I predict the day will come in the near future when you will not be able to buy any of the supplements you currently can buy. I also believe that organic gardening, as we now know it, will cease to exist in the next same 2 years. I believe that now that Codex will become official in just 3 weeks and all those herbs and all those countries will be gone, I believe that the next move then will be harmonizing that into the food safety bill, which has language in there that allows for this harmonization. And we've already been fully aware that Barack Obama is opposed to freedom of choice, radically opposed to it in all matters, and he is on the site, completely bought and paid for by the pharmaceutical industry and the biotechnology industry. We will certainly do all we can to push back, but remember what we're pushing back against: a complicit and accepting media of the official position, completely corrupt FDA and CDC and U.S. Public Health Service, totally compromised, and about 900,000 utterly compromised physicians who would not stand up for anything. You don't see them in marches. You don't see them sacrificing anything because they've ceased being healers. They're nothing more than prescription writers for the pharmaceutical industry in most cases. The small number who have joined in the alternative movement are not enough to make a difference. That does not mean we will lose, and it doesn't mean that we will not expose a lot of their corruption. And that's why I'm putting so much energy into the films I'm doing now, to show how corrupt our entire healthcare system is. But I'm just letting you know it's already happening now in Europe, and from Europe it'll come here. Back in a moment.
Sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now to our issue section. And after this issues, I'd like for you to call in and share your point of view. And I'll give you that number after this. This is from Sarah Seltzer, and it says, Aaron Sorkin and David Fincher's Oscar-nominated Facebook original myth, The Social Network, has little to say about the new generation or the spirit of the Internet age. It's also got race and gender problems. It was made in Hollywood, after all. But what it does portray with chilling accuracy is the way elitism can get under people's skin, leading to an endless craving for recognition and being set apart from the masses. In that sense, it depicts a uniquely American strain of ambition and a uniquely American way of solving the problem of being an outsider. Rather than a film about changing an unfairly rigged system to distribute power, it's about seizing power for oneself. The film reveals that process to be both initially satisfying and ultimately empty, as are all attainments of status. That's why the Harvard setting works. The film's Harvard bears an uncanny resemblance to the Harvard where I studied as an undergrad just ahead of Mark Zuckerberg. The film's Zuckerberg is a made-up character, so for the purposes of this piece, I'm referring to the fictional Zuckerberg, the fictional Winklevoss twins. A typical Harvard freshman class contains hundreds of youth who resemble this character: ambitious, awkward, privileged, and insanely competitive. Previously, they were yearbook editors, science whiz kids, sports captains, and student government presidents. They've won scholarships and been valedictorians. They genuinely believe the Harvard acceptance letter validates their years of striving and stress. Their parents, for the most part, could afford SAT tutoring or private school tuition, or at least a chunk of Harvard's hefty price tag. These legions of young and precocious arrive at their bastion of ivory-towered academia and discover they're not unique. Thousands of their peers have credentials just like theirs, and maybe, just maybe, the subconscious idea begins to materialize. Getting into Harvard isn't purely a reflection of brainy merit or hard work. Instead, it's often a result of socioeconomic status, connections, and luck. But for most people, contemplating one's privilege is more daunting at Harvard and in America than making it charged at the ranks of those who have even more. Indeed, the pathways of storied universities like Harvard are still trod with people like the social network's pitch-perfect archetypes, the Winklevoss twins, these good old boys and girls, shockingly present, are often the trust babies of families who have been attending the school for generations. Sometimes their names are shared with entire buildings. As in the film, they can flash a trump card at their maladjusted genius classmates, an easy sense of entitlement and a handshaky familiarity with each other. That coveted clubbiness extends to the much-debated final clubs, the male-only social groups that occupy so much of a poor Mark Zuckerberg's thoughts in the film. These organizations are indeed frequently on the minds of many young people at Harvard. Why wouldn't they be? Harvard is, in a sense, a higher education's own final club. It holds the promise of a gated community access by merit that promises its entrants prosperity and social cachet. At other Ivy League schools, social clubs have different names and aren't all male, but they all serve the same social purpose, to further the foundational illusion of members-only exclusivity at institutions like Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. And these are built on the same idea. The Vegas-like final club parties shown in Zuckerberg's fevered imagination during The Social Network may have been an exaggeration, but the reality of these events was worse. At final clubs, students actually dress up in seersucker and straw hats, puff cigars, and pretend to be the waspy ruling class of yore. It's as silly as it is offensive, most assuredly, but it's also a dangling reminder that however much privilege and power you attain, there's always someone out there with more. The irony the film catches is that in today's reality, such old-school gland-handing and posturing matters less than actual grit and talent. But it still matters enough to rankle to spur our protagonist's vengeance. In The Social Network, Zuckerberger chooses to forge his own path to the mythical fruits of Final Club membership, money, success, girls, elite status. After failing to get invited into the clubs themselves, he trounces the old money buffoonery of the Winklevoss twins with ruthless capitalist entrepreneurship and founds an internet empire. Within the parameters of the film's world, the socially hapless Zuckerberg is a compelling anti-hero, and his choice to hang the twins out to dry is satisfying. On the flip side, his decision to screw over his slightly dopey friend demonstrates the loss of his soul in the process of winning the game. To be sure, by zeroing in on the ambition versus old money dynamic, The Social Network excludes many other narratives. But it's also true that the insular world of captured by the film remained a disproportionate influence on campus. A wealthy number of my peers were as consumed by the clubs as the financial Zuckerberg was, and would have bulldozed their way in if possible. They were frequent efforts to turn other activities at Harvard into final club-like experiences, with hazing rituals and inane ceremonies. More and more social groups sprung up with punching processes that mimic the final clubs. Secret ceremonies and retro outfits all soothed and validated an alleged specialness that in reality stood on flimsy foundation. Again, the mind tricks played by elitism, the idea that you're never in the inner circle, isn't unique to Harvard. Sorkin, the director, succeeds in pointing to an unfortunate quality embedded in our national character. Zuckerberg's angry fixation with the clubs exists in American life as class represents resentment channeled into perverse identification with the privileged class. It's a disease way of thinking. Zuckerberg's ultimate unhappiness at the film's end reveals the misery inherent in trying to fight an unfair system by going after your share of its fruits. He didn't want to dismantle the final clubs and create a level social playing field, but rather to gain access to its benefits for himself. And yet, as he discovered, the system created to maintain an illusion is inherently empty at its core. Of course, in conclusion, not everyone watches the movie will realize this. After all, the parties of glamour, the prestige of running Facebook appeal for the same reason final clubs appeal to the fictionalized Zuckerberg. They represent an elite inner circle that's out of reach. Now, think of Facebook. I declined to have a Facebook page for a long time, and then It was Kara Lee of our Progressive Radio Network program director who said, a lot of people would like to share insights and information. And if we let people know that ours is not a social place to date and to share a lot of stupid information, but to really be for serious-minded activists on issues that are important to them, share articles and videos and comments, I said, fine. 99% of the information that came in was of silly natureness and people's really extended egos and just loneliness. And I just said, then scrub it. I'll either take it all off because I have no interest in that, or for people who do care about the world and sharing, then let them be on and tell the other people that there are other gazillion other places they can talk about what they had for breakfast this morning. And that's what we're doing now. And so we're getting far more people who have something relevant to say and to share. Because at the end of the day, who's looking out for us? The Federal Reserve? No one. How about Congress? No one. How about big business? No one. How about our educational system? Clearly no one. So you look around at all the ways that we have been manipulated and used, commodified and commercialized, and you say, shouldn't there be some movement to help challenge this? Well, there are certainly movements, and there are individuals who very much care. There are a lot of people who are very conscientious. But getting them to communicate with one another, that's the challenge. Getting them to donate some time and energy to make themselves informed on an issue and then share that with other people who can then see what they know and pass it around. That's more daunting. And we keep coming back, there are only a small number of people in the United States, I mean in the entire country, who are actually out there doing some good work to share with other people. And I'm not talking about the environmental foundations. You could just write most of them off. They're just self-serving and they've been sold out to the polluters, with rare exception. And the egotists and the people who are such rigid ideologues in the Green Party or, you know, the dark and down stupid side of the libertarians. Now, if you took the best of all movements and you cut off the bottom part, the part that really isn't good, so that they were all progressive, and you had the progressive Greens, the progressive constitutions, progressive libertarians, progressive liberals, the progressive conservatives, progressive peace party, and you brought all those people together in one form and then said, okay, how can we go forward? There are more of us than there are anyone else, but we're not organized, so we're not getting any of our way. The laws and everything else are in the hands of those who are organized. And then get them to work on issues that are important, we could make it a better world. And I believe that's worth putting the effort out for. But you got to understand how many people come out of these Ivy League schools and they don't give a damn about anything except themselves. They care about, are they going to get into the right house in the Hamptons? Or who's got something better than them? It's all about ego, and that comes from insecurity. And that's not going to change. So we've got have and have nots. It's too bad 60 Minutes didn't pay attention to why we have one in every four children in the United States in poverty and hungry. Not a word, not one syllable about how did we get here. Ah, because then they have to be facing their own advertisers and the people that finance the networks and the hedge fund people and the equity partnership people and all those people that they're very chummy with. And that's not something anyone's going to do. You do that, and suddenly doors close, and you're on the outside. So we get bits and pieces of the truth, but we're never allowed to see the whole story. Your thoughts, your turn. Call in now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And I also want to thank all the people who showed up yesterday for the World International Film Festival, the Queen's showings. It was a wonderful afternoon. It was supposed to have been a 20-minute Q&A. It went 2 hours. In fact, we had to actually find another place in the building because our time had come and gone. Another film was showing, but a lot of good feedback from people who saw the film, Death by Medicine. Back in a moment.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love, I'm all shook up. Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, my hands are shaking and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I hear the phone in the engineering booth starting to go, so I look forward to having your calls and your comments. This is your chance, your opportunity to call in. I'm a big believer in interactive radio, interactive medium of any type. So give us a call at 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear from you. And while we're getting some people up on the line, I'll give you the latest on nutrient of the day, and it's about blueberries. And what's important, I've been, by the way, you can watch today's show by going to GaryNall.com and or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and I'm in my studio in New York City. I look forward to going into our new studio, which we're working on. In fact, we were working on it all day today, and we'll work on it until the wee hours trying to get it ready for this week. In any case, I've suggested many times that you should start your day with a health shake. And in the health shake, you put some coconut oil, organic raw coconut oil, flaxseed oil, some high-quality probiotics, and then some polyphenol-rich fruits. Now, that would be blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, cherries. And four or five different types of fruit would be terrific. Some protein would be outstanding. And then some, your greens and red fruit concentrates. And then you're really good to go. I mean, you're super potentizing your body. But just to give you a little more insight into why the blueberries are so important, because blueberries can combat diabetes. There's an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association that talks about this. And in fact, this landmark JAMA report was published in 1927, and it showed the ability of blueberry extract to lower blood sugar levels. And now we're looking at how you can maintain good blood sugar. Now, many of you know that polyphenols are the very powerful part of the blueberry and a lot of other berries. We also know that it can lower high blood pressure, it can help with obesity, it can lower your blood lipid levels and prevent heart disease and diabetes. But there's a lot more that it can do. Now there's new scientific evidence that blueberries can help combat multiple forms of cancer. And here's how it all works. As conventional medicine has ignored these findings, and they have, researchers just keep piling up the evidence that blueberry polyphenols can target factors such as metabolic syndrome. And the polyphenols have also emerged recently as potential powerful anti-cancer agents, so it can actually prevent cancer. And these have been shown in recent double-blind studies. For example, in a recent double-blind placebo-controlled study, 32 obese insulin-resistant pre-diabetic adult men and women drank smoothies made with freeze-dried blueberry powder for 6 weeks, or a placebo. And participants were carefully screened and counseled by dietitians both before and during the study to avoid eating other anthocyanin-enriched foods or beverages. And they found that there was a substantial difference in insulin sensitivity. It was 22.2%. That's a big difference. In another study, 48 individuals with metabolic syndrome and high blood pressure and central obesity around the abdomen, elevated blood glucose, insulin resistance, also had a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and they also benefited, and it also showed that they had substantial lowering of this. And And also, for those of you who want better pancreas functioning, and even today I was counseling someone who's a well-known on the left as an attorney who has stage 4 grade B pancreatic cancer, which is orthodox medicine has no hope at all. So I gave him a protocol, and hopefully they will use it. But one of the things that's very high on that list is blueberries, blueberry extract. Scientists zeroed in on the blueberry anthocyanins, C-Y-A-N-N-I-N-S, as part of a group of 600 water-soluble phytochemicals that give many fruits and vegetables the deep blue or purple or red or near-black colors seen in vegetables like radishes and black raspberries and blueberries. Now, the anthocyanins comprise part of a larger class of plant pigments and flavon-derived plant products known as flavonoids. Now, both classes of phytochemicals are encompassed by the antioxidant supergroup polyphenols, carbon-containing organic compounds with a wide range of antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and blood sugar-regulating actions. Well, in part, in vitro studies carried out using cultured rodent pancreatic insulin-producing cell lines showed that what is called a delphinidin 3 glucoside, the pigmentary compound that gives blueberries their deep blue color, stimulated insulin secretion more than other test anthocyanins. And this means they may boost much-needed insulin production in pancreatic cells damaged by diabetes, and that would help you tremendously. And there was a very detailed report that diabetics are predisposed to a horrifying range of cancers, including their breast cancer, liver cancer, colon cancer, pancreas cancer, endometrium or uterine lining cancer, kidney and other tissues. And just as the anti-diabetic drug metforminan has proven a potent anti-cancer agent, blueberry extracts are emerging as a powerful chemo-preventative intervention as well. Now, in vitro studies have revealed a host of anti-cancer properties shared by blueberries and anthocyanins, other flavonoids, found in brightly colored fruits and vegetables. This is why you should have your red, ideally 3 times a day, and your green powders 3 times a day, because you're getting all of these wonderful, potent bioflavonoids that neutralize reactive oxidative species. And by inflicting damage to cell structure and DNA, those bad reactive oxidative species can induce the development of cancer in healthy cells. So by having these blueberries and other anthocyanins, you inhibit the accretion of new blood vessels essential to tumor growth. That's called angiogenesis. And then the blueberries and other berries impede the spread of tumor cells to different locations in the body. That's called metastasis. And third, they stimulate cellular maturation or differentiation into less injurious or malignant forms. So they tone it down. So that's one of the reasons that we should have blueberries each day in our diet. And if you're getting your powders, you're getting it. Well, let's take some calls here. If you want to call in, this is your final opportunity, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Back in a moment.
Baby, let me be your love and take you back. Put a chain around my neck and leave me anywhere. Let me be,
oh, let him be
your own teddy bear. I don't want to be a tiger, because tigers play too rough.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. We have Dr. Martin Feldman on the line. Marty Feldman is a board-certified neurologist, qualified in psychiatry, associate professor of neurology at Mount Sinai, author of dozens and dozens and dozens of peer-reviewed literature in the field, and he's been the scientific supervisor of more than 45 separate clinical studies that we have done over many years and presented them at scientific conferences on a wide variety of topics. We're going to go first, Dr. Feldman, and then we'll come back to your call. So please hold on when you call in. Nice to have you with us today, Marty.
Hi, Gary. And most of those studies have been very important and very positive. We're moving the whole field of nutritional medicine forward, which is rare today. We've done more studies probably than any other group in the whole country.
Yeah, but there's no doubt about that. I've seen the other literature. The one we're doing right now, you were there Wednesday evening and you heard the people, how are you doing? That's the first thing we ask them. And people were talking about they have more energy, they're sleeping better, local infections are not there. Several people said that for the first time they've gone through a winter without colds or flus. They don't have local pain. Cognition is better. Memory is better. And, of course, we'll know in a couple of weeks when we're at the end of this study how much difference it's made in their particular conditions. Now, today, Marty, you're going to talk about what happens if you have chest pains and it's not a heart attack. What else might it be?
Okay, very important topic. It could be a heart attack, but I'm going to talk about something which is not a heart attack. It gets confused very, very often. That is what's called a hiatal hernia, hiatal hernia. What that is physiologically is that the stomach goes up beyond the diaphragm up toward the throat. And that's a herniation of the diaphragm, and it can be very, very painful. Now, the question is, why is that occurring, and what's the story? How do we fix it, and what's the real underlying reason? Well, there are a few aspects. One aspect, it could be part of a GERD, a gastric reflex problem, whereby the stomach has the improper acid, has fermented acid. It's not working properly. Therefore, foods ferment in the stomach, make an abnormal acid, and that irritates the whole stomach and also irritates the esophagus and may be part of a hiatal hernia. Most of the time, that's part of the process, but sometimes the hiatal hernia occurs on its own because if the stomach is not working totally optimally, then we have to get the stomach to work better, because if it doesn't work biochemically properly, it works mechanically. Mechanically is such that when it needs the food and when it has to move mechanically back and forth, it forces up through the diaphragm. We've got to get it to work biochemically. How do we do that? Well, the key to stomach function is the stomach acid and the pepsin. The stomach acid is usually repairable. It may take, let's call it, time and energy and expertise, but it's repairable. And here's some of the ideas about what we have to do to repair the stomach acid. Zinc, cabbage juice, food allergy control, that is identifying and eliminating food allergy, aloe vera, DGL licorice, that's DGL all caps licorice, marshmallow herb, and then occasionally we have to test for H. pylori, and if that's part of the stomach problem, it has to be corrected. So we want to get that stomach to work right so it doesn't have to push up through the diaphragm. What about some of the foods involved with this whole process? Well, first off, until we get everything really optimized, you should have smaller meals in general, no fried foods, in general less spicy food, no coffee, very little alcohol, if any, and no sodas. The food, it's a very important aspect, get the foods controlled. Next would be, what else can we do? Well, we can do, first, if you do start to get this hiatal hernia pain in the chest, then the first step would be to take 8 ounce glasses of water, one or two right together to try to bring the stomach back down. That's step one. Beyond that, you have to do no food past 4 hours to bedtime. If eating food in the evening tends to make the whole stomach, esophageal, hiatal hernia problem worse, very bad, that has to be stopped. Also, it does sometimes help to raise the foot of the bed 6 inches or more. Next would be tight clothing around the stomach, around that area should be avoided. Lifting and bending should be avoided as much as possible. Also, obesity. Many persons with obesity have a tendency toward this hiatal hernia as part of the obesity. Now, here's the confusion. The confusion is it's hard to test because a traditional physician, even a gastroenterologist, does an endoscopy. Endoscopy is a tube down in esophagus into the stomach to basically test the stomach, we'll call it anatomically. And the problem is they may see a hiatal hernia at that moment, or they may not see it at that moment because the hiatal hernia is fluctuating. It occurs, and it's a sliding hernia. It comes up and back and up and down. So they may not see it. And if they do see it, they usually have no idea what to do. So what else do we have to do? Well, I found over the years, and for most of the persons with hiatal hernia, we do all this stuff biochemically, but also they often need chiropractic help. That's very, very, we'll call it advanced concept, but this is very, very remediable partially from chiropractic help. And the other problem is this. to test for that hiatal hernia requires usually not just endoscopy because it's sliding up and down. You have to use energy medicine, either electroacupuncture or muscle testing, whereby we test that hernia process right on the body's energy system. We can often define if the hernia is there or not, and it helps us with, as time goes on, as fixing the problem. So here we have a problem of a medical condition which is not appreciated, and fortunately it's not a heart attack, and it's usually reversible, and it should be addressed, and it should be dealt with.
Good information. Thank you very much, Marty. I appreciate it. Marty Feldman can be reached in his office at 212-744-4413. Let's say hello to Patricia from Deer Park. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Gary. Great to speak to you tonight. I just wanted to mention that 2 weeks ago tonight, I had heard Dr. Helen Caldicott on the Progressive Radio Network, her program, If You Love This Planet, broadcast a speech she gave to Port Hope, Canada. And she mentioned that one should not buy any organic fruits and vegetables from Europe because of the fallout from Chernobyl. And one in particular in the United States, we should not buy Hershey's chocolates because the Three Mile Island, that fallout was 30 miles downwind from the dairy farm that Hershey's used and powdered the milk and put in their chocolate. I was wondering, since I've been shopping for organic for years, and I see things coming from Yugoslavia, Italy, and Turkey, that how one should be so careful as to figure out if there's any problem with that.
There are several ways we can do this. One is, wherever possible, buy local. In fact, just yesterday, I managed to get enough local farmers who are certified organic to start a whole local certified organic section in the health food store. Otherwise, the organic is certified, but it comes in different places in the United States. My argument is, the closer something is to the source that it's going to ultimately consume it, the better it is, because it's fresher, it's generally within 24 hours of being harvested, and also it has less of a carbon footprint than it's leaving. Now, when it comes from other countries such as Chile or Australia, New Zealand, South America, in the wintertime, because when we're in our winter, they're in their summer, my problem with that is, and we've declined from doing that. For example, there's a lot of items you'll find in some other stores you will not find in mine, for a simple reason. You can bring them in, but you're causing an enormous amount of pollution to get them in, to fly them in. And I just have a principle, I won't do it. And so you have to just accept, during different parts of the year, you can buy frozen, that's fine. But otherwise, you're just not going to have the fresh. Like right now, unless the grapes are organic in the United States, I'm not going to buy them from outside. Now, some people say, well, what does it matter? I want my grapes, you know. Fine, then go to another store and buy them. I think that we have to get out of this idea that we can have whatever we want, any time we want it, in any amount we want it, without any consequence. There's always a consequence. Now, with Helen Caldicott, who's in Fatal Fallout, I might mention, about the dangers of nuclear radiation, she's talking about that radiation, once it is polluting an area, it just doesn't go away. It has a long half-life. And we saw that with a higher incidence of cancer around Chernobyl. For over 20 years after Chernobyl, there were higher incidences of leukemia and birth defects and miscarriages and other forms of cancer. So the radiation doesn't leave the soil. Therefore, like around Three Mile Island, she's absolutely correct. I wouldn't have anything from around Three Mile Island because of the pollution of the soil. They didn't remove the soil. And our depleted uranium is now polluting all of Europe. In fact, depleted uranium monitoring devices have picked up depleted uranium coming from Iraq into England. I actually filmed the scientist who did the measurements. So buying where you get local grown is better. There are some items that, if you're concerned, you can ask the manufacturer, what is the test on this as far as radiolytic particulate matter? And they can actually do the study. And I believe that to enhance their marketing, they should do that, to show that it's not only organic by local standards, but it has no particulate matter in it that would be a problem as far as radiation. Okay, does that answer your question, Patricia?
Yes, thanks so much, Gary.
All the best to you. I'm Gary Noll. We're coming up to the end of our program, and I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. And the whole purpose of every program is to impart thought. Let us start to think in ways we hadn't before. I do 15 hours of live broadcasting a week, and that's about to go up another 15 hours. Some stations want me on 5 days a week around the United States, and I'm considering that. Pay attention to the information. Share it with other people. When you hear the numbers tomorrow, because I just got them in tonight, of how many people are just downloading programs over the Internet, it's mind-boggling. How did that happen? No ads, no news stories. I don't do news stories. I don't even do interviews, haven't for a long time, because if they want it to be about me, I have no interest. If they want it to be about information, sure, but they don't want it to be about information. Not in today's media, the celebrity-driven media. And so I just know, word of mouth will still get it around. Well, boy, is word of mouth working, especially for the progressives in this world. It is working. We're sharing. There are millions and millions and millions of you, and we're all sharing. We just have to be better organized, focus upon a few really important issues that we can all agree upon, and put our collective talents to work, and then get some political action and social action and make it an issue. So I thank all of you who are conscientious and concerned, and please do not use my Facebook page unless you have something relevant to share or information that we can all learn from in a constructive way. Personal information about your life, yourself, dating, no interest. You can put it up, I'm going to take it down. Okay? It's only for social relevance. All right? One final thought before we go over to our next guest. A man and his ever-nagging wife went on vacation to Jerusalem. And while there, they weren't that happy, but the wife passed away. And the undertaker told the husband, you can have her shipped home for $5,000, or we can bury her here for $100. And the man thought about it, and he said, oh, ship her home. The undertaker said, but why? Why would you spend $5,000 to ship your wife home when it would be wonderful to bury her here and you could spend $100? The man replied, long ago a man died here, he was buried here, and about 3 days later he arose from the dead. I just can't take that chance. Thank you all for listening.